views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. I want to tell you that my show is really expanding. We are now going to be 5 days a week. Well, actually, probably going to be 3 days a week, and I'm going to have a couple hosts help me out because right now, I'm not going to be able to do 5 days a week. I have an ethics club now teaching at the University of Minnesota at the business school, and it's a pretty new program, and so there's a lot of new material that I'm bringing, which I think will come and help the show as well. I'm really excited about what I'm doing there, but I'm also excited about the show expanding and having a lot more airtime. I have great stuff lined up all 5 days this week, and we will be doing, I have Dark Journalist joining me, which is, he's awesome. It's like the real life X-Files. And he's going to be on Tuesdays and Thursdays in January during my time. And then I'm going to be doing Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then in February, I'm not sure how much Dark Journalist is going to do because he has all these television projects. So we're kind of playing it by ear exactly, but I have a lot of awesome stuff lined up. So it'll be a lot of fun. And that is Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern time every day. And then WBLQ has bought a new station. And so my radio show is going to expand with them as well, AM and FM on the New York, Rhode Island, Connecticut area, the East Coast. And we'll see where that goes. I'm pretty excited about that. That's 3 p.m. on Mondays. And then, of course, we're on 7 days a week on Transformation Talk Radio, which I love that as well. So you can hear me all over the place because we're on YouTube, Stitcher, we're on iTunes, 100 different digital channels streaming live and in podcast. So you can find me anywhere. Make sure you join up for my newsletter. I have a lot of articles that I also write. And then subscribe to my YouTube channel because then you can share my videos and things with your friends or anything that you have. You can also share my articles. I love it when people share because I like to get the word out on what we're doing. But today we have a really interesting topic that we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about neuroscience, and that whole field is just exploding. There is so much going on there. According to scientists, they claim that neuroscience is actually in its infancy, and they compare it to our understanding of physics maybe at the time of Galileo. I mean, there's just so much more to do in the understanding of neuroscience. I mean, we talked about nanotechnology and how that's a exploding area. It's a whole universe of little things that we can do so much more, building blocks. But this is the same. Now you can do nanotechnology. You can really get it in the brain and do a lot of stuff. And, you know, of course, there's ethical issues behind it. That's why I love the fact that I'm doing this ethics course. But there's a lot of good and a lot of great possibilities as well. So there's a lot of fascinating things that we can get into. But think about this. Do you realize that with the brain, remember in Matrix when they were talking about downloading, or when they were showing how they were downloading a program so that the person could, Keanu Reeves, his character, Neo is his name, that he could fly a plane, you know, just by downloading that information. And it was so cool. I wish I could just download stuff and know how to do things. They actually have done some really primitive experiments with mice, and they've been able to program a mouse's brain to understand a simple maze, a maze they've never done before. They just program it into their brain, which tells you that likely in the future they're going to be able to program human brains, which is obviously brings up some ethical concerns, but it shows you where the world is going. Stanford is doing some research with the mouse, And they're actually able to control the brain of the mouse so they can control their actions. So when they're just kind of moving erratically, they can get the mouse to run around in perfect circles and do what they want them to do. So, of course, you know what the future of that is being able to control not just animals. You could control farm animals. You can do some things that might actually help us. I don't know if that's ethical or not. But you could control farm animals. You could have them do the things that you want them to do, which would be interesting and probably pretty useful. But then think of DARPA, the secretive research arm of the Department of Defense. They are starting to do this stuff, too. They are now implanting chips into soldiers' brains in the hopes of enhancing battlefield performance and to repair traumatized brains. Now, I can see both of those things being really good things. Now, if you have a traumatized brain, it'd be really great to be able to repair that. We have such a high level of suicide in our vets that if you could do something like this and actually go and repair the brain, how great would that be? And also, if I was in a battlefield situation, I sure the heck would want my brain supercharged so that I could get out of there quicker. I would have super senses. I would want that because I would want every advantage I could have over my enemy not to get killed, even if I was a soldier. I know the ethical implications of creating, you know, these super people, but if I was one of them, I sure heck would want that. That's just me personally. So I think there's other people that would want that personally as well. So I understand that perspective. But do we want to go there? Do we want to get to a point where we can control their actions, their behavior, and be able to enhance their performance? It's pretty interesting where the brain is going with the research in that field and what that all means. And you know as well as I know these, my listeners know this, if something is capable, even if the 99% of the people who are ethical, the mainstream, the everybody, they might not do it because they know it's not ethical. You know the 1%'s out there that will do the unthinkable because they can. Anybody who's thinking about whether it's ethical aren't the problem. It's the ones who don't even give it a second thought. That's where the problem lies. So there will be lots and lots of discussions coming up over the next decades as our technology and our capabilities go so much farther and just kind of blows all of our minds. There are more discoveries happening every day than people even realize, and people can't keep up with it. It's just so fast. But today I have a very fun person coming, and we're going to be talking about what we know about the brain. He writes books, and he does speeches, and he does all these things, and he does that in more of a humorous fashion. And it got pretty serious in this conversation, and we cracked jokes here and there, but he told us a lot of really interesting information about the brain and how it works. And we talk about the mechanics of innovation. How do people innovate? How does language impede innovation? We talk about prodigies. What's the difference between adult and child prodigies and how is that made up? And then we talk about the reality of perception and how we're different than animals, and really fascinating. So we are going to be inviting Ransom Stevens, who has his PhD. He's a physicist, a science writer, and a novelist, and he is very entertaining. And let's welcome Ransom Stevens to the program.
Hi, Ransom. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Sarah.
You have an amazing outlook on some of the things that you're doing. You're a successful physicist, but you get into all this writing, novels and nonfiction and fiction books, and really dive into all these different topics. What got you into doing that?
Well, I've always been a writer. It's always been part of what has made my career successful, all of them that I've had. You know, going back, I was in the high school newspaper and the college newspaper. And as a professor, I cranked out lots of articles. So it was pretty natural. And I always wanted to be a novelist, and writing science is something that I sort of do compulsively. So it all fits together. And as a physicist, going to write about neuroscience, well, that was kind of a trip, I got to tell you.
Why is that?
Well, what happened was I was researching a novel, my second novel, The Sensory Deception, and its premise is based on concepts from neuroscience, essentially how the senses interact with the brain to sort of create what we think of as the mind. And I was describing this to a publisher, and while she didn't immediately jump at the novel, she did turn to me and say, "You know, I bet you could write a really good neuroscience book." And my response was kind of like, well, but I'm a physicist, you know, how could I write a neuroscience book? And she said, well, you're a science writer. So I was on board, because when you're a writer and a publisher asks you to write a book, there's only one answer.
Yes.
That's it.
And if you're kind of in the realm of science and stuff, they don't really make a distinction, do they?
Well, as a science writer, no, they don't. As long as you can bring an interesting perspective. So that's really what I tried to do, was to look at this. Neuroscience is a very new science. It's in some sense, it's kind of at the point where physics was when Galileo first started picking up a telescope.
Yeah, we don't know much about the brain, do we?
Well, we're getting somewhere, but yeah, the tools are just starting to be developed. So it's really got like 20 years, 10, 15, 20 years of really good data. So it's baby science. So I tried to take a look at it as somebody from an old science looking at a new science, hopefully with some ability to use that experience to take a guess at what will survive, you know, which results are going to still be around in 10 years and which will have fallen by the wayside.
Well, one of the biggest premises that you have is that jargon and the way our brain takes that in, it messes with our ability to innovate and discover. What do you mean by that?
Well, let me explain that then. Yeah. So jargon is one of the things that we do, and it's something that comes from our, you know, our evolutionary need to survive, and that is to build tribes. And so it's the sort of thing that businesses do. And in that sense, yeah, it's something to really think about. And so what jargon does, in particular the fabled three-letter acronym, is that it locks people out. We develop our own internal language, and we think of it as the language of experts. But what I've seen in high tech and in science is that certain companies or certain labs will develop their own jargon and think it means that they're experts. But then when they go and talk to another company or another lab, they either realize that they're speaking a different language, or they make the mistaken assumption that the other people don't know what they're talking about. So it's a very easy trap to fall into, especially for people who have just learned this new language, because it seems like, well, now I'm in the team and, you know, I'm part of this new clique. And we all have some experience like that where it's sort of exciting to be part of a new clique, to fit into a society. But when we build up walls, and that's what jargon does, then we keep other people out. And when we keep other people out, it's not just people we're keeping out, it's ideas. And of course, ideas are you know, kind of related to innovation in some sense.
But doesn't that happen in finance? And doesn't that happen in all sorts of industries that we think are a lot more complex? And isn't that kind of the basics between not being able to communicate with China or Mexico? You know, I mean, because they just speak a different language.
Well, that's a much, yeah, different languages is the same thing on a much larger scale. And it certainly has that effect.
But we just don't even have a clue what they're talking about with jargon. It's like we know what they're talking about because we speak the same language, but then there's a bunch of other ones, so we're just clueless as to what they're talking about. How about, it's kind of like our kids, like a teenager. I don't really know what they're talking about. Right? And they don't know what we're talking about. I think that comes more with experience.
When it comes to innovation, though, we know a few things about how innovation really works. And can I read you this quote? I love this quote. It's a little bit long. It's from Mark Tucker,
who's
the CEO. Yeah, all right. So Mark Tucker, this guy is the CEO of the National Center on Education and the Economy. And he said this: one thing we know about creativity is that it typically occurs when people who have mastered two or more quite different fields use the framework in one to think afresh about the other. Intuitively, you know this is true. Leonardo da Vinci was a great artist, scientist, and inventor, and each specialty nourished the other. He was a great lateral thinker. But if you spend your whole life in one silo, you will never have either the knowledge or mental agility to do the synthesis, to connect the dots, which is usually where the next great breakthrough is found. So, in other words, what Tucker says is that Lateral thought is the birthplace of innovation and creativity, and it tends to happen when people move from one field to another. When expertise from one field is brought to another field, that's when things really start to happen. And when we use jargon, we prevent that, because then the person from the other field has no idea what you're talking about and so can't contribute, and we lose those ideas. But it's worse than that, because all of these things that people do, they scale. So if we do this externally with other people, we also do it internally within our own brains. So when we use jargon, we prevent our own brains from bringing concepts from one field that we understand to another field that we understand. It debilitates us. So jargon's bad. Stop it.
Well, it's interesting. I moderated a panel for the U.S. Competitiveness Council on 10 to 20 years out of where medicine is going to be. And it was interesting when we had all these different experts, because that was just one topic. There's three different topics, one on the future of manufacturing, one on the future of energy. And it was very interesting to hear the speakers come up and talk about how the inventions are coming from people from other fields, and how, or from different applications that we happen to port over to this application. It's very common. In fact, that's where most of the inventions come from. So I love hearing that whole concept, because that's so true. I was telling my son, because he's in engineering school at Northwestern, and I told him, he's thinking about going into computer science. I said, well, you can't just do computer science. You have to figure out how you're going to apply it to other things. And that's why, and I, you know, when it comes to nanotechnology is all the sciences coming together. I mean, you really need to understand kind of that whole ball game in order for us to really go forward. So that's where the future of everything is.
It's where the past came from too. And so this is the thing, is that you can really get a boost on your career to make, by making career transitions, but like any transition, you know, transitions kind of suck, because you got to go from one world to another. And there's this in-between stage that's very awkward. And when you get to the other field, you have to learn the whole language.
And so they don't appreciate what you know from your other field.
There tends to be that, you know, it's interesting. I went to work for a startup, these many years ago. It was a wireless web startup. And before wireless was anything, it was during the era of, towards the end of the era of pagers. And we were doing,
I remember
pagers, 1999. So we were doing new wireless applications that nowadays are things you use all the time. We were doing early forms of text messaging and broadcast messaging. And the CEO, who was a very entrepreneurial spirit, really an annoying guy, you know, really a pushy, hard driving, classic Type A guy, but he hired me to direct advanced technology, to direct a team of engineers. So I was a physicist, an academic coming in to lead a bunch of engineers, and I didn't understand their language at all. And they thought the CEO was crazy, you know, for about a month when we started to gel and I solved a couple of problems, and they started, you know, you got to earn your stripes. But in bringing in someone from outside, my experience was, well, we cranked out a few patents, we developed a bunch of technology, then, you know, the economy crashed and we all went our separate ways, but for a while.
Yeah. Well, engineers tend to pee all over each other until they respect each other, right? I mean, they're just, that's just notoriously how they are. They don't respect anybody until you prove it to them. And unfortunately, they do have their silo thinking. And, you know, it takes some time. But that's what the problem is with politics, I think. I think we're extremely like that right now. We're just all in our silos and we're not seeing. Because I have this radio show and I have some people who are just barraging me with emails or Twitter things and all sorts of messaging on why I'm not covering all of Trump's bad things that he does. I'm like, well, I don't even really, I'm thinking, I don't even really cover that type of material, for one. And to that degree, I'm more into business and I try to look from an independent standpoint. But every point that I made to these people about, you know, corruption all over, I just tried to be more neutral and independent and just tried to show them some stuff. I couldn't make a word. I couldn't get a word in edgewise. And now I'm still getting like 100 messages a day on why I'm not doing all these different things. And it's an extreme of how people are. They get into their silo, and no matter what anybody says, they have a certain way of thinking.
Right. And responding to those, the first thing is, are you telling me that you don't find Twitter feeds enriching?
Well, now when I'm just getting barraged with crap, some of that stuff is great, but now I'm being added to all these different tweets, my name. And so then I get all those updates, and it's people that think I'm not covering the right stuff. And I'm just, oh my gosh, leave me alone.
Well, I have, you know, this is a struggle, right? It's a struggle to figure out how to do things that you believe are right that will be effective. And having rants, you know, going off on a rant is in a way building your, well, it's not even in a way, you're building walls that way. And that's, rants aren't going to convince anybody of anything. What convinces people are sound ideas. And I think that's what you do, right? If you go head to head with direct high-level policies and just say they're wrong, that's not really going to have any effect on individuals who aren't implementing those policies. But if the concept of, for example, innovation, I mean, we've got a lot of big problems to solve as individuals, as a society, as a country, as inhabitants of this big wet rock, and we need all the tools we can get. And that means we can spend more time working on how to solve these together than when we might have a chance. And if we just push back on each other, then I don't recognize that as being extremely effective. So,
well, no, when we have all sorts of problems, we need to look at it objectively. We also know that there's some ethical things that are going on, right? We all, most people can agree on a lot of stuff and a lot of problems that we have. So why don't we come together and solve some of these problems together? We know that our healthcare, the system is out of whack, right? The costs are out of whack. We know that there's too many people in prison. we know that there's all these issues. So let's kind of come together on some of this stuff. But yeah, and so it's probably us. We're speaking past each other in a lot of instances.
Well, let's take a look at that word, though. Look at things objectively. I learned a lot of things that I learned when I was researching The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, and learning neuroscience that kind of, you know, annoyed me. And one of them was this concept that we can look at things objectively. We can't. It's impossible. It's an admirable thing to try, and, you know, we can get
that's
close.
That's probably very true, yes.
But we can't do it. It's simply impossible. We don't have the capability of doing it. We have five senses, and everything we know about the universe and ourselves and everything, our entire realities are built from those inputs. And those inputs have a very tiny perspective on the mass of reality. So we can't look at things objectively. It's worth trying, but I think it's important to realize that that all we're doing is trying, and to recognize that our opinions will frequently get in our way.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you have to make opinions on things. Like if you have ethical views on things, well, that's opinions on helping you move forward in one direction or the other, right? There has to be a framework that you're working within. Otherwise, you can't get and what your goals are. You know, what are our goals? Well, we want everybody to prosper and thrive. Well, if our goals are, no, I want this group to prosper and thrive and not the rest because I don't care about the rest, that's a different decision-making process.
Well, it's historically going way off this topic, but historically it doesn't work either. When we cherry pick who is going to thrive and who's not, it tends to lead to war. So that's probably not the most effective way to maintain peace and contentment and harmony in these sorts of things that we probably are more happy with than without.
That's probably true. Cause that is, that is true.
Well, vast majority of history, right? People have had something resembling civilization for 15,000, 20,000 years. And of that, there's really only a couple of hundred, 300, maybe 300 years out of 15 or 20,000 when society wasn't essentially a feudal system with one or two extraordinarily wealthy and powerful people. And then for each one of them, maybe 1,000 people who are not quite slaves, but arbitrarily close to it. So it has been an enlightenment, you know, and that's why they called it the enlightenment. But it's not a stable system. The stable system, if you remove all of the rules that we've built into our civilization, then it will collapse right back to feudalism and another dark age. But that's the topic of a novel.
It's not what you came to talk about, but
hopefully it's the topic of a novel and not reality, but hey.
Yeah, let's hope so. But we're more enlightened, so let's not go back there. But you, let's get into this left brain speaks, the right brain laughs. What's the purpose of that book? What were you trying to get out of that?
So the purpose of this book is really, well, you know, for personally, I wrote it, my selfish reason for studying this was to learn about innovation and creativity so that I'd be better at innovating and creating, you know, as a technologist, as a scientist, and as an author. But also, I've always been fascinated by why people think something is good and other things are bad. Like, for example, what's your favorite color?
Mine?
Yeah.
Probably like a light blue or something. A bright, like a, okay. Yeah, like a royal, not a light, but I don't know, like that blue that is intense but lighter color.
See, you almost got it right. The best color is, in fact, a cobalt, a bright blue.
Yeah, that's what
royal blue.
Oh, not royal. I'm thinking more like the blue from an ocean. You know, like the.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm with you. So the point being that value always seemed to me as so subjective that, you know, what's your favorite color? If you'd said orange, I would have said you were wrong. But how stupid is that, right? But then some books and movies and songs become very, very popular among the people. And so are those good, even if the critics don't like them? Or alternatively, if the critics like something, does that mean it's good, even if the people don't like it? So there's this sense of arbitrariness around value. And that's one thing I was really interested in, is why do we value some things and not others, especially in the arts and sciences?
Well,
in technology,
it
tends
to
be easy.
What's the deal with the blue and the orange? And what were you meaning by that? That blue color is what most people like?
No, what I mean is that your favorite color is so subjective that for one person to say that their favorite color is the best and the other colors aren't as good is just stupid.
Oh, okay.
It's just that subjective. So, you know, which is your favorite book? Which is your favorite color? Did you like this song? Well, I didn't. You must be wrong, right? There's this – and gold. Why is gold valuable? Well, because it's shiny and yellow and rare?
Yeah.
We sort of agreed that it would be valuable.
Well,
and
now,
so it's valuable.
Well, gold and silver are starting to be valuable for other reasons once you start talking about manufacturing and actually things that you can use it for. But it's like it's like diamonds. You know, well, are they valuable for what they're used for? Or are they valuable because you like to look at them? And if it's for looking at them, well, there's other options that look just like them that would work too.
Right. And gold is a tremendous conductor. It's got a nice hard oxide, and that means it doesn't tarnish. And so it does have properties that we value. And using them, and, you know, when it becomes useful, then it's got a different kind of value, like copper. You know, the price of copper has gone up because it's so important in making electrical devices. So that kind of value is easier to understand. But value in art is very difficult. You know, there's the artist Charles Kincaid, right? He's mm-hmm. made more money with paintings than anybody in history, maybe everybody combined. Oh, I doubt that. I hope not anyway. But he is not critically acclaimed. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen one of his paintings in any of the great museums that I've visited, though he is in a lot of malls. So if the people like, you know, if people like it so much, why don't, you know, what's the difference? So this is something I really wanted to get into.
That's true. And why is it that he's not liked by the art connoisseurs, but everybody else likes him. So who gets to decide what is great art and not great art?
Yeah. And why do we need critics?
Yeah. And how can you claim that that isn't when you look at like abstract art, when there's just like a fly on a wall or something, how can they be better at deciding that's good abstract art than anyone else? You know what I mean? Especially
yes,
when you
that's
get to
exactly,
that stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly where what I was curious about. You know, for my own selfish reasons, so I can write novels that are more popular, but also still pleasing to me. And so that's the field of neuroaesthetics. So in my book, The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, I cover topics sort of similar topics that we tend to think of as separate, things like nature and nurture in each chapter. So each chapter name is two things, a dichotomy, a pair of things that we tend to think of as separate but are deeply related. Talent and skill is a good example. Art and science is kind of where it builds up and builds up to these concepts of neuroaesthetics. But to get to them, got to understand the basics for how the brain works. And then the neuroaesthetics kind of starts to make sense about why we like some things more than others, because we like to solve problems. So here's an example. Jigsaw puzzles. Do you like to do jigsaw puzzles?
I do.
You do. So aren't they a trip? I was at a ski lodge, one of these places where you can rent a room and it's got a big common kitchen and, you know, there's snow all over the place and there's dozens of people milling around of all ages. And I've always thought jigsaw puzzles are stupid because, you know, if you want that picture, why don't you just buy the picture instead of cutting it up and putting it together, right? It just seemed like a big waste of time to me. But then I find myself standing there waiting, you know, in line to get a cup of coffee. And there's these kids doing a jigsaw puzzle next to me. And I'm just watching. And then it got me, right? It got me. It's like, oh, God, I know where this piece goes. It goes right there. And then I'm hooked. And it's the buzz. It's a dopamine buzz. We like to solve problems. We like to recognize patterns. We love the blast of, I get it. The aha. I understand. This is something that's very important to us. And so that is one of the roots to what makes art good, both in the popular sense and in the critical sense. That merging where something, you know, kind of undeniably is really good, where it sells well and the critics like it. And so what it is, I think, you know, and this is from assembling, you know, studying all this neuroscience and then kind of putting the pieces together. So it's less based on compelling evidence than it is on my own distillation. And that is that the critics have more refined problem-solving, puzzle-detecting, puzzle-solving wetware in their brains because they do it more often. And so to please a critic, the puzzle has to be harder to solve than it does to please someone who doesn't spend all their time solving these puzzles. So when you look at a painting or when you read a book, there's lots of little things in there that tickle your brain. And the more tickling they do and the more that tickling resonates and is deep rather than just something you just get and then you can walk away, which is sort of what jigsaw puzzles are, right? Once you've put the whole puzzle together, you're kind of done. But with a great work of art, you keep coming back to it and you keep getting feeling from it. And that feeling comes from lots of things, lots of processes like recognizing patterns, like solving little mysteries in the painting and in books, real mysteries. All books, one of the ways that writers keep your attention in a novel is to withhold information. So they get you going, they give you bait and kind of drag you along. And the buzz is in the anticipation that you're going to solve the puzzle, not in actually solving it, but the anticipation that you're getting there.
That you're going to figure
closer,
it out?
You're closer.
Well, what is
yeah.
that? Why is it that critics like things and the average person might not? That there can be
so
highly critically acclaimed things that the average, the majority just, they don't like it. It's not, doesn't sell well,
right.
Whatever.
Right. So this is one of the things that really puzzles me. And so I'm close. I think that the path toward the answer to this dilemma is that the critics spend so much time solving these puzzles that they just solve them faster. So they don't get as much buzz unless the puzzle's much harder to solve. And so the rest of us will see it and be absorbed in it and start solving that puzzle and get a nice, healthy buzz, and we'll love that. But somebody who's, you know, a critic who studied this for decades and decades might just look at it and say, oh, it's trite, it's hackneyed, it's on the nose. You know, you look at it, you see it immediately. It's too easy. So they don't get the buzz. You see what I mean?
Well, and then with something that they do, it might be too hard. It just might be.
Right.
It's too much effort.
Or boring.
Yeah, it's just too much effort. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, okay. You claim that there's the right-left paradigm with your brain is oversimplified. Why is that? Why is that an oversimplification, the right-left brain paradigm?
Well, oversimplification plagues all sciences because, we're stupid apes and we're trying to understand very complicated things. So we have to oversimplify things. The reason that the oversimplification of the left brain being your inner accountant and the right brain being your inner artist is oversimplified is that it's outdated. That idea came from research that was done in 50, 55 years ago, where there was evidence that showed that if signals from the right brain were suppressed, people were less creative than if signals from the left brain were suppressed. And so that became the genesis for this notion that the left brain is less creative than the right brain. But there's a lot of evidence that's happened in the ensuing 50 years. So it's time to upgrade the oversimplification. So I have a new oversimplification for you that's less oversimplified, but still an oversimplification. And that is that the real distinction between the left and right brains has to do with how they focus. And the title of my book, The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, is a kind of marketing version of what I really wanted to say. And that is that the left brain tells the joke, but the right brain gets it. So the left brain is the thing, you know, when you tell a joke, you kind of tell a joke, you tell a little story that goes off in a direction. It's usually pretty mundane and it's sometimes boring, but you know it's a joke, so you pay attention. And the punchline is when you take a left turn or a right turn, when you make a turn into something that is inconsistent with that story. And if that inconsistency, if that punchline is absurd, then it's funny. If it's harmless and absurd and ridiculous, then it's funny. And the more ways that you can interpret that punchline, the funnier it is. Now, if it goes the other way and is not harmless and absurd, but is horrible, then that's what horror is. So this is an example of the left brain being the thing that focuses, using the cliche of the forest and the trees. The left brain is the thing that figures out the leaves, is focusing in on the pine needles and the acorns and the pine cones and stuff. And the right brain is the one that's aware that you are in a forest.
But so, isn't it both important? Because let's
so
say
right,
you see
that's
this.
That's kind of the thing.
Because with the right brain, let's say you just see this mass of stuff. But until you know they're trees, you don't know it's a forest.
Exactly. And you're not creating much without both of them on board. Your left brain.
It has to go back and forth.
Your left brain is deludable. Your left brain is the part of you that does fantasies, that takes you off on little fantasies. So you're not going to create much without it. But the right brain dials you back. Your right brain has got the big picture in mind. It's the one that looks out for you. So your new and improved oversimplification on the left and right brains is that your left brain is a curious child and your right brain is the indulgent parent.
Well, it's almost like it synthesizes the information.
Right. And that's why we do tend to think of it, and there is a germ of truth to the old simplification that the right brain is creative and the left brain is more analytical, because the left brain does focus on the smaller details but you're not going to create much without focusing on the smaller details.
Because you don't even know what the big picture is without the, because the big picture is only a collection of the small details. And so you have nothing to synthesize if your left brain can't do a good job at it.
That's right. You need both hands on deck to get anything really, really wonderful accomplished.
Well, you dive into all sorts of big topics too. And this is a really kind of esoteric concept, but you have alone or together is what you call it. And then you dive into, are we a hive? Are we all connected unconsciously? What do you mean by that?
Well, hives are really interesting things. And it's possible, even, well, I don't know, I dare not say likely, but one of the ideas of how consciousness forms is that our brains are similar to beehives. And let me explain what that means. So it's this concept of emergence. Emergence occurs. It's like when you see birds swarm, it kind of looks like they all know where each other is going, but they don't. The swarm emerges from their interactions with their closest neighbors, from, you know, each piece of the hive, each bee in the hive plays its role, and then the hive takes on an even greater identity. It is ultimately, it's the ultimate form of the whole being greater than its parts. So if you think about a brain and how your mind comes about from it, what you have are about 80 billion different neurons that are connected. Each neuron has an average of 10,000 different connections. And so what that means is you have, well, trillions and trillions of different connections in your brain right now, and the possibility of making more connections than there are grains of dust in, well, more than there are atoms in the universe. So you're never going to fulfill your potential was the bad news on that.
Well, that's good to know. But at least if you think that you're just done, you fulfill your potential, then what do? You know,
yeah.
Okay, it's like finishing a puzzle. You have to walk away. What do I do? Okay, I've met my potential.
Yeah, well, I guess that's it for me. I'll die now.
Okay, so you got into animals and people, and we see the world differently. We have a completely different perspective. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is this. Here's an example. A dog. Dogs see the world differently than we do. Our primary sense, that one sense of the five, sight, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching is sight. We operate primarily on things we see, but dogs operate primarily on things they smell. And it alters their perspective of the world totally. And I think we can learn from that. And so think of it like this. If I come into your office and hang out for a while, and then I leave, you see me leave. All of the light that's reflected from my body leaves, right? It's not there anymore. But if you were a dog and I came in and hung out for a while and then left, my scent lingers around. So to a dog, I'm still there. I'm going away, but it's a very different time scale of their understanding of the presence of another smelly thing, like a, you know, another animal. So, and whales are even better. Whales see things by hearing, by projecting sound. Yeah, they, by using sonar, they project sound and then they reconstruct images from the echoes that are bounced off the objects that they sent the sound waves to. So that changes things completely, because instead of seeing colors the way we do, they would actually see things like rigidity. A piece of steel would ting, right? It would have a tingy reflection compared to a rock, which would have a duller reflection, or, you know, a clump of sand or an octopus or something.
Yeah, we wouldn't even know what their paradigm is. It would be very different because their sight is sound. It would just be a completely different paradigm.
Yeah, it's such a trip. I based my novel, The Sensory Deception, it's built on virtual reality. And so I did actually a first person look at the world from the point of view of a sperm whale in there. And so, yeah, that's what really got me into neuroscience, was studying that sort of thing. But here's a fun one. If you are in a bar with a bunch of whales underwater, when a whale comes in and it looks at something, everybody knows what it's looking at, because it has to send the sound at that thing there is no peeking among whales. It's kind of like
they all know what each other are looking at.
Yes, you cannot peek. You are not looking out the corner of your eyes at that person. They know what you're looking at.
So and they are connected. They are connected more than we realize. I mean, they're a herd. Are they a herd animal technically? I mean, do they go in herds or are they individually when they're out there in the ocean?
Pods. Yeah. They act like most of the mammals other than the felines. Yeah. They assemble in pods. You know, all of the different whales, the dolphins tend to be in huge ones. Some whales tend to be in smaller ones, but they hang out together.
Well, then they're constantly communicating. I mean, they're just, they would be kind of like a hive mentality, knowing that everything they look at, they know what each other is doing.
Well, they're a society. I don't know. A hive is a very different thing. And so like in your brain here, let's finish that hive idea. So in your brain, you got these 80 billion neurons.
Yeah, you're saying
how does
we're
that
more,
make up you?
You're saying we're more like a hive and whales are very different from us. Okay, keep going.
So your brain has all of these. Think of it as 80 billion bees in your head creating the hive. And you, your self-identity, your awareness, your consciousness, that is the hive. That's the hive behavior.
You're not saying that humans altogether are kind of like a hive or like a swarm of birds or whatever. We're like our self is like a hive. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think that's very, very defensible that something happens when there's either a level of complexity to the number of different interacting parts that then takes on a different awareness, which, you know, that's what we are. And something like a society, or an army or a company of people who work together, that's not a hive. Though we can try to be more and more functional, but since we each have an ego, bees don't seem to have egos and neurons certainly don't, but, that kind of prevents us from,
wouldn't that be awful if a bee that didn't like you had an ego? That would be terrible. But
well,
go
they've
ahead.
Got their instincts.
Well, I take that over ego.
Yeah, I don't know. Ego can be dampened. Instincts will just get you, you know, maybe keep you alive, but kill everybody else. It's a mixed bag. Civilization is hard. You know, we're working on it. It's a work in progress, civilization. But it is possible, and I don't want, you know, this is kind of new agey, and I certainly wouldn't say that I believe it, but it is an interesting thought that each neuron is not aware of your being, of your self-awareness, of your consciousness. Each bee is not aware of the hive. So if there were a sort of hive-like awareness among the inhabitants of Earth, among people, each person wouldn't necessarily be aware of it. And with, you know, approaching 10 billion people, each one with 80 billion neurons, that's a lot of processors. And things do emerge from it, like neighborhoods and cities and countries. So a lot of things do emerge from it that are sort of hive-like, but probably don't have consciousness. But who knows, right? This is something that some religions really like to get into.
Does the hive have its own separate consciousness with bees? I mean, we don't know.
Well, that's the thinking. Yes. Yeah. That's the idea. It does seem like that among bees and ants, that the hive is capable of doing really astoundingly intelligent things, adapting to different situations in ways that, that make, you know, building dams look, excuse me, that make building dams look trivial. So hives are a trip. Hives are really special.
Okay, well let's talk about talent and skill. You explore the concept of where talent stops and skill takes over.
Yeah, so this is a great example. This is one of my favorites. Because talent and skill are things that we tend to think of as separate, but go ahead and try and separate them. Right? So when we can look at it at the extremes, and this is a technique that's used in physics and mathematics all the time, where you look at a system and then think if you can solve how it behaves in really extreme cases, then sometimes you can kind of pull them together and get an idea of how it works in more complex cases. So talent and skill are like that. And here's an example. There was this guy, Manute Bol. He was a basketball player. from Africa, and he was 7 feet 9 inches tall. And that gave him a decided advantage in playing basketball because he could drop the ball through the hoop. He didn't have to jump. Now me, I'm 5'7". He's got a distinct advantage over me in getting the ball through the hoop because I got to throw it way up there, right? Or try to jump. And he doesn't have to do those. So he's got an obvious talent for playing basketball. And I don't. All right. So that's a talent. It's a simple one. It's a purely physical one. But if we're going to separate them, then there you go. Now, on the other side of the coin, there was this guy, Muggsy Bogues, who was shorter than me. He's 5'4". And he was also an awesome basketball player. So would we say that Muggsy was all skill and Manute was all talent? Well, probably not, because if Manute Bol hadn't practiced, then, you know, he wouldn't have been a very good basketball player.
Yeah, but isn't there something to do with coordination? Some people are just born very, very coordinated and they're very athletic, whereas other people aren't. Yeah.
Yeah, but right. But that's a tougher one to separate because that's not as an extreme a case. Because the more you practice, the better your agility gets.
Well, so, and some people who are come out not coordinated, if they practice a lot, they can take over the people who are naturally coordinated. I've seen that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the point being really that talent independent of skill is no better than, well, I don't know, maybe skills devoid of talent is better than talent devoid of skill, but you kind of need both. And the glue that brings them together seems to be passion, right? Take, for example, the greatest basketball player of all time, Michael Jordan. He was a little bit short. You know, he was like 6'4", 6'5", and the average height of a basketball player is like 6'6". So all by himself, you know, he was in pretty good physical shape, but he did not make the varsity basketball team in high school. Didn't make the team. So he went on a training tirade. One could say that Michael Jordan became the world's greatest basketball player out of spite because he was so angry that he didn't make the team. He just went crazy practicing. Jerry Rice, who was, arguably certainly one of the great football players of all time, you know, was famous for practicing. He was not the fastest guy on the field, but hardly anybody could catch him.
Yeah, passion. So, I think passion is where you use your passion on focus activity that helps you become better is something that's just completely unmeasurable. You can bypass anyone who doesn't have that passion. If you have the underlying talent and a potential to get there, right? There is something about that potential factor.
There is something about it. And it's something that is so difficult to measure that, well, let's just say the science isn't even close to probing that. We have things like IQ tests to try and reduce something that is a really complicated thing into a single number. Yeah. Now, this is I liken that to analyzing whether the quality of a football field by the height of one blade of grass. It's just, you know, it tells you something, but whether it tells you something useful or not just isn't clear. And the IQ test, while I don't know if it tells you anything or not, but one thing it does not tell you is something about somebody's future success. There was a huge study done in Britain over 40 or 50 years now, where IQ tests were administered to children, and then their later success was analyzed in terms of, you know, their income, their social standing and stuff. And there was no correlation. Higher IQ did not correlate to a more materially successful life.
Because passion
on the other hand,
and surroundings and environment has so much to do with it too.
So much to do with it, right? But there is a test that does correlate to success later in life. And that is the following. Take a bunch of three-year-olds, okay, and offer them a cookie. And as they take that cookie towards their mouth, you stop them and you say, all right, look, I will give you a second cookie, but only if you put that one down for 10 seconds. If you can wait 10 seconds before taking a bite of the cookie, I'll give you two cookies. And the kid that can delay gratification, that's the one who's going a long way. The one who starts gobbling down the cookie and then doesn't get the second one, well, they're not going to do as well.
That's interesting. I wish we all would have had that test when we were little to see how we ended, what our natural tendency was. I wonder if I would have waited. I would have hoped I would have.
I don't know. I don't know. At three, who knows? I tend to do that now. I did it to a fault sometimes, you know. It's like I look forward to doing something so much that I just keep putting it off, dangling it in front of myself, and then sometimes, you know, it disappears. Well, and I miss
but
it.
But so
that.
Fun about three is that when we're three, it would be just raw, right? It's whatever we have.
Yeah.
That's why it would be so interesting to see what we do.
Well, exactly. That's right. That's exactly right. That then it is raw. And how much of that is genetic is really, I mean, that's where it gets interesting. This, the nature and nurture thing. And yeah, I have an example of that that I really like.
Well, do your example, and then I want to get into prodigies.
Okay. So my example is this. Clark Kent, all right? Superman. Nature or nurture? Well, yeah, he's Superman. Come on. He had to have been born with that. Except on his home planet of Krypton, he has no superpowers. Only on Earth, with its yellow sun, does he have his superpowers. So is it nature or nurture? It's not, if it's nature, then he should have it everywhere. But
well,
if it's nurture,
it's nature because he has it when he's here. We don't have it when we're here. So that would have to be nature.
But when we're on his planet, he's no, you know, he's not special.
But maybe
so
we
see,
are. Maybe we have those powers there.
Exactly. And in which case it's all environment. And but that's just an example of the quandary, you know, one that kind of hits us close to home. So you want to talk about prodigies?
You talk about child prodigies and adult prodigies. And is there a difference? And what's the deal there?
Yeah, there's a huge difference as it seems to pan out. And again, you know, it's neuroscience, so it's no better than, well, the uncertainty is at least 10% in anything I say. But prodigies, this savant phenomenon of, you know, the child who can play Mozart, the child who can do arithmetic wildly, wildly well, is what we think of as child prodigies. But they don't tend to continue to get better as time goes on. So it tends to be a more mechanical glimpse of what seems like genius, the ability to count, you know, to count the number of leaves in a tree, you know, like the Rain Man could with the number of matches in a box or something like
that.
Yeah,
he dropped the matches or something.
Yeah. So there exists this thing, but that doesn't mean that the Rain Man's going to be any good at calculus. All right. So child prodigies, this is a really cool effect, but there's two things about it. One, the child who can play any song on the piano by ear rarely becomes a great composer, doesn't create the great songs any more often than, you know, somebody who learns to play the piano by being tortured by their parents when they're eight or whenever you learn to play the piano, which I guess that was around 10 when the music lessons started in, right?
Depending on your parents, but yes.
Right. I wish they'd force me to take the piano. That'd be a cool skill to have. You know, you don't walk around and see trumpets sitting around very often. You can't just pick one of those up and in a bar and start playing.
Yeah, you think of the parents as evil parents or the kid as you know, you hate it. But later on in life, you're like, oh, I'm really thankful I have that skill.
Man, I had a roommate in college. He was this wild biker dude. You know, he was all leather and Honda and just insane. He was, you know, taking every toxic substance known to man, getting mediocre grades, but passing. He was just a wild man. And we go into a bar once and there was a piano and he sat down, and he just started playing. It was just fantastic that, you know, the tough guy is playing a sonata in the bar.
it's one of those things where your brain, it threw your brain through a loop because you didn't see him that way.
Exactly.
So what
love
is
that
the
multi-dimensional?
What is, oh, yeah, I love that. What is the adult prodigy deal?
So the adult prodigy is our hope that we can be good at something that we don't know anything about yet, right? That the confluence of talent and skill driven by passion, that's where it really happens.
Oh, so like the Michael Jordan.
Develop your own.
The Michael Jordan is an adult prodigy. He wasn't born with it, but the passion, talent, and everything coming together turned him into this phenom.
Right. And, you know, we all have that. We all have our little areas where we have that. And there's some cases where we can all share it. And one of them is the ability to speak. All right. Here's kind of a neat little example that seems so trivial that it seems like it's not even worth mentioning until you take a closer look at it. Now, is the ability to learn a language a talent or a skill? Well, you're not born with knowing a single word, right? You're born with the capacity to learn a language. So the human beings are born with this talent to learn languages. But ask any dog, any other animal about talking to each other. Would they like to learn a language? Well, it's pretty hard, right? There are a few chimpanzees who've spent their entire lives and managed to learn to communicate at the level of, you know, a two-year-old. So this is a place where we can all share in our prodiginess that, my God, you learned a language. Do you have any idea what an astounding accomplishment that is? That we are born with this talent to learn languages. We're not born with a single word. But boy, the people can learn languages and they learn to read, right? Everything we do, we tend to abstract. So from language with its grammar and structure, then we put it on paper. We create the written language. And then from that, we get mathematics and computer programming languages. And who knows what comes next?
Yeah, we have the ability to be abstract. So the combination of from an intellectual prodigy, it's the passion, the time, and just it's a constant concentration on the topic, right?
Yeah, yeah. But also don't overlook the bringing together other expertises, right? Other fields, because that's where the innovation happens, which is kind of where we started, right?
Exactly.
Is that one of the things, I don't know, I keep talking about sports, but sports is a really good place to talk about talent and skill, because the talent seems so obvious and the skill, how you get the skill, is also pretty obvious by practicing. Now in football, there's been this phenomenon for the past decade or so of the position of the tight end, which is a great big guy. You know, they aren't all big in football, but these guys are, you know, 250, 260 pounds, but very, very coordinated. And the reason is that they came from backgrounds where they played basketball, and basketball requires a lot more hand-eye coordination than football, because you got to get that damn ball through the hoop. In football, really, the quarterback's the only one that has to be able to get the ball in one place. And the receiver, catching is easier than throwing. So these tight ends have just swept the league and really changed it, because they're bringing skills from one sport to another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another example of how innovation happens.
The best athletes can bring everything together. And I've heard, like, artists, they bring science into the way that they do their paintings and their, and with music is very mathematically oriented, or film. Film is really science oriented, you know, with all the different dimensions and things in it. There's just a weave of so many different things together. It's pretty remarkable.
So that's what all my whole book builds up to, is how art and science are similar and different.
Well,
and,
I heard, you know, I don't want to cut you off. I want you to finish this, but I was reading, you know, the Renaissance artists, and Michelangelo, I think it was a quote from Michelangelo. They thought he was just a prodigy. And he said, if they had any idea how hard I worked before they thought I was a prodigy, they might not think that. It was really interesting to hear him. You know, they just worked their butt off to get to where they were at. But go ahead.
It is it's a funny thing. You know, somebody who's really, really talented is sometimes offended when you say, well, you know, you're really talented, because, gosh, it must be easy, right? Or you have no talent. There's no winning in this, right? Oh gosh, you know, you have no talent, but boy, look how skilled you are.
Oh gosh, that's worse. I've heard that he,
I don't know, man.
He's not really that smart, but he works really hard.
Right. Overachiever. The curse of the overachiever.
Yeah, he's not that smart, but he works hard.
But also think about art, though. The actual doing of art and the actual doing of science tend to be very, very similar. And they're both involved, you know, they both require tremendous amounts of creativity to move, you know, to move the frontier of knowledge forward in science requires the ability to do things that no one's ever done before. And art simply is doing things that no one else has ever done before. And so they're very similar. And I like to think of Michelangelo when he was carving David, right? This giant statue of sort of the perfect man, the perfect person made out of marble. So he gets this big block of marble, right? And when we go and see it, I think it's in Florence or something. I don't remember. I've never seen it in person. I saw a replica in London.
I'm not sure.
But when he was building it, you know, let's face it, it probably looked a lot like bricklaying. There's a lot of dust, a lot of chipping away. Right. And science, doing science tends to be like that, too. There's a lot of scratch paper produced. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of debugging software, a lot of trying, you know, a lot of pouring one fluid into one beaker and to another. And the actual doing of it doesn't, you know, it doesn't reek of the romance of the actual discovery or the finished product.
Yeah. It's like watching hot dogs get made. You know, it's just not that good to watch.
Right. But it all of that centers around neuroaesthetics, the aesthetics of what we think is good. And so we pursue different topics in science based on what we think is valuable, what we think is good, what we think that bottom line is to understanding the universe or to understanding any given system. And in art, it's very similar, but also very different because while in science, you know, we try and understand something in a way that is objective, in art, it's really about projecting feelings. When an artist can put you in the frame of mind of that they had when they were creating the art, then they've succeeded. So if I write a book and have characters and I go into those characters and I understand them and their feelings and their needs and what they yearn for and what bothers them and what threatens them, if I can get that into your head so that you're reacting to it while you're reading the same way that I was reacting to it while I was writing it, then I win. You know, then we all win. That's where the juice is. That's the good stuff. And it's the same thing in art. And you mentioned abstract art, and modern art is very much this, except that the reality is stripped away. So it's like having a metaphor, but removing the part that you understand with the logical part of your brain and just leaving the part that gets your guts. That's what the abstract art seems to try to do. Well, it is what it tries to do. It's metaphor without the details. So, you know, and this is all stuff that was revealed to me by studying neuroscience and talking to neuroscientists and psychologists and behavioralists. And boy, was that a trip. And so that's the culmination of the left brain speaks, right brain laughs.
Well, so now how can
with,
people...
lots of wisecracks along the way.
Well, that's good. You need that because you need to laugh.
Yeah.
So how do people...
Well, I have a very short attention span. So, you know, when I see something that I think is funny, I can't hold it back. I'm gonna crack the wise.
You have to. It makes world so much more worth living, right? Makes your life...
Yeah, well, it gets you sent to the principal a lot in school, though. But, you know, in the end,
whatever.
It's worth it.
Whatever. You're not in school anymore. Right. So how can people learn more about you and get the book?
So the book is The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, and it's available. It should be available at all of your bookstores. It's certainly available at the great big bookstore that's accessible to you through your computer. It ought to be at the bookstore on the corner. If it's not, I'm sure they'll be happy to get you a copy. And if you don't want to pay for it, go to a library and ask them to get The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, and they probably will. So, you know, libraries are great resources. And if you ask for something, they almost always get it for you.
Yeah, excellent.
So there's that. And I have a website, ransomstevens.com.
And I'll put that up on the radio page as well on my website.
Okay.
Yeah, good. No, you can say it. What else did you were going to say?
There's Twitter and Facebook. I don't really encourage people. If your Twitter feed is like mine, I recommend not looking at it.
That's terrible. I don't mind Twitter. I like it because I do get some good stuff from it. But it's just now that I'm getting a barrage of other people, I just like, I'm not sure now.
There's a couple of people on there that I can dig up and find things. But mostly it's, you know, just this blur of 141 word comments that are indistinguishable in most cases from noise. And one of the things I learned from the writing about neuroscience is that if we really want to get to use our brains more effectively, the trick is to increase the number of patterns that we recognize fast. And to do that, we need to be exposed to a lot of patterns and not exposed to nibbles and pieces of them like we are on Twitter, or like I tend to be on in my Twitter feed, but to get the whole picture, which is something you're more likely to get at a museum or reading books or talking to people or going to lectures or hanging out and watching people in the street or even going to football games and, you know, getting out there and taking classes. But education in its largest sense, really, I guess it's not ironic at all, but it is the juice that makes our brains more effective. It's quite remarkable, really.
The focus, the concentration. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate it. And I think our listeners are going to find this is really fascinating. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome, and have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific Time. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.